Consumer credit data held by credit reference agencies and other organizations have become an essential part of the financial market, both in the context of lending and borrowing, debt collection, and the broader scale of things such as making the financial sector sustainable. The data can also be used to develop innovative tools to create and improve personal finance products. Welcome to Debt Talk Podcast with me, your host, Rippon Ray. This time, I'm speaking about a very crucial topic, credit ratings and debt. To navigate such a subject in this podcast, I have a very full house. I have two representatives of two major credit reference agencies, James Jones from Experian and Craig Tebbett of Equifax UK. I also have Chris Dick from Registry Trust, which holds data from English courts, and many are undoubtedly related to criminal and civil courts. And finally, Chris Leslie from Credit Service Association, that represents debt collections organization in the country. Let me start the conversation with James Jones from Experian and get the basics out of the way. We get that credit rating is here to stay. Can you explain to listeners the reasons for having a report and historically how that was developed and what problem is it here to solve?
So firstly, thanks for having me on. The problem that credit reporting solves is helping lenders and other providers of credit accounts avoid providing credit facilities to people that either can't afford them or have shown a track record of not managing them on time. And obviously that's problematic for an organization. So what organizations have done now for many, many years is work with a number of authorized credit reference agencies to share limited information about their customers' credit commitments with each other through sort of centralized secure platforms like the one that we operate at Experian, that they can use to help make informed decisions and responsible decisions. And also, of course, because most lenders are commercial firms, profitable decisions as well. My employer Experian sort of been in this business for about 45 years now. We were spun off from a Great Universal back in 1980, which at the time was one of the country's biggest retailers, and it had started computerizing its own credit records internally and also sort of doing some pioneering work to develop what we now know as credit scoring, predicting how people will behave in the future based on their current and past behavior. And that was basically turned into a service that other organizations could join from 1980 onwards. And it remains a very important part of credit decisioning to this day. So we work with hundreds of organizations who take part in our credit data sharing scheme. And that includes, you know, financial services firms regulated by FCA, as we are, covering, you know, current accounts, credit cards, car finance, mortgages, all those types of things. But it's wider than that these days. So it includes mobile phone contracts, catalog, other retail type of accounts like buy now, pay later, which is, you know, sort of massive now, I think, in the UK. But also providers of regular household bills like gas, electricity, broadband, TV, those sorts of things. So the chances are, if you have accounts with various providers, including banks and lenders, where there's an expected monthly payment or a financial commitment, you'll see that if you check your credit report. And you know, there are three main credit reference agencies in the UK: ourselves, Equifax and TransUnion. We do a similar job. The chances are, if you checked your personal credit report with all three, they'd probably look very similar, maybe not identical, because currently the sharing of this information is done voluntarily, and some organizations choose to just work with maybe one or two. So you can get differences, but the likelihood is they'll tell a similar story.
I mean, how does a lender or a bank get information about an individual? Is it through a consumer credit agreement or is it based on legitimate interest? What is it?
Well, when you apply for a credit product. The lender will sort of include in its notification and terms and conditions information about how it works with credit reference agencies. And there is a sort of a standard body of words, if you like, called we call it CRANE, Credit Reference Agency Information Notice, which spells out very clearly what will happen to your personal data if you proceed with the application. And obviously, at the beginning, that starts with running a credit check with one or more credit reference agency to help them decide whether you fit their criteria. And then, if they subsequently do open an account, then registering information on, about how that's managed going forwards as part of its commitment to, you know, help all of the credit providers lend and manage credit responsibly. So under the Data Protection Act, because of course we're talking about personal information, you have to have a legal basis for processing personal information. The lenders do it, as far as I understand, as part of the contract with the customer, so it's a contractual thing. As far as the credit reference agencies are concerned, we do that under what's called legitimate interest, which is basically, you know, that's what our business is and we're authorized to do it.
Just to kind of go deeper into the actual information on credit file, do we need to worry about our information being passed without our consent?
Well, consent is another one of those bases for processing information, but I think there are about six. And as long as an organization satisfies at least one, then that is all fine as far as the regulators are concerned. And of course, there's organizations who make a living from looking after personal information and helping banks and lenders use it to make, you know, sort of good decisions. We're very much committed to keeping the information safe, keeping it secure, and making sure that it's only accessed by the right firms for the right reasons at the right time. So that is very much a top priority of a credit reference agency.
I mean, we must not hide behind the fact that credit reference agencies are a data collecting body, just like Equifax we have here. You are a business too. Who buys your data and what are the main reasons for buying the data?
So the way we kind of, you know, cover our costs and maybe sort of make a little bit of money as well. The kind of the remuneration model, if you like, for credit reference agent credit referencing, certainly in the UK, is lenders send their information to us, and that's all free. So you know, there's sort of very low barriers to them actually engaging with us and working with us. Maybe a little bit of kind of IT setup cost if they're new to credit data sharing. But then what happens is when lenders actually process an application and want to, you know, access the information with us, we will charge them a small fee for each credit report they pull. Additionally, we will, and I think this, you know, this is a true across all the credit reference agencies, we also develop and offer other tools and services alongside the data, typically to help lenders, banks, lenders, and so on, make sense of the data. So that's where things like credit scores come in, affordability scores, which are slightly different, you know, fraud and ID checks, those types of things. But the core of it is the credit data. But quite often, if you know, look at the relationship between, say, Experian and one of the major banks we work with, we're providing other things at the same time to help them, you know, ingest that information and use it to make good decisions.
Speaking of scores, yes, the credit score determines whether I'm creditworthy or not. How is that decided? Is it decided by creditors or individual credit reference agencies? How does that algorithm fits in?
Yeah, so I mean, there's no single credit score, there's no universal credit score. It's simply a method, a process for boiling down all the information, either just on the credit report, which is typically the scores that credit reference agencies offer, or across all of the different information sources that a lender would have at its disposal. So the information on the application form, maybe information they have already if you've been a customer before. And it's just a way basically of using that information to understand the likely risk that someone will manage credit successfully in the future. There's no sort of standard approach to this. There's no standard amount of points that you could be awarded for different types of behavior. There's no standard, you know, top score or distribution of scores on the scale, whatever the scale is. So you'll see a number of different approaches, both by the credit reference agencies themselves, because as I said, we provide scores if lenders want them alongside the data to help boil all that information down into a three-digit prediction of the likelihood of missing payments. But lenders might, you know, may or may not take that, or might just calculate their own scores in-house. But you mentioned, I think, algorithms. It is an algorithmic discipline, I think, creditworthiness assessment. So what you're essentially doing, it's a long time since I did A-level maths and stats, so forgive if the terminology is slightly off, but you use a correlation really to look at groups of past customers, maybe groups of customers that were excellent customers, groups that were, you know, actually quite poor, maybe some in the middle. And you use correlation, and it's regression analysis, I think is the term, to identify patterns in that data that you can then use going forwards in terms of scrutinizing new customers' applications to match them together and predict how those customers are likely to look based on the past. So it's using the past to predict the future. So that's how a credit score card, if you like, is configured. You're basically programming a number of algorithms to appraise data and predict the future based on your experience with other customers. That experience will differ across different sort of creditor sectors. So you might have one, I mean, even with a, you know, a bank that offers different credit products, you might have a number of scores with them, depending on what you're applying for, because your risk in terms of that credit product might differ. So it is quite complicated. The credit reference agencies, I think, have worked quite hard in recent years to try to help the public understand this better. And certainly at Experian, we've not only launched a kind of a guide credit score for the public, so people can, you know, sort of get a feel for what their credit data is likely to mean to a typical lender. But we've also shared example score factors from the Experian credit score to help people sort of better understand how different types of behavior are likely to be reflected in our credit scores.
So, I mean, speaking of public interest, where does the Information Commissioner and the Financial Conduct Authority fit into the data sector?
Yes, well, I mean, we think of them both as regulators, key regulators of that part of our business. So the Information Commissioner's Office, the ICO, obviously they're the watchdog for data, for personal data. And the Data Protection Act, you know, forms a framework that we sort of process and store and transfer data based on. And it sets, you know, sort of minimum standards and expectations, like we were discussing around the bases for processing, but also it gives the public, you know, the right to obtain their information, gives the public the right to come back and challenge the information if they think it might be accurate. So all of that really is set out in data protection legislation, whether it's the latest Data Protection Act or GDPR or whatever comes next. So that remains very central to our day-to-day work. Alongside that, you've also got the Financial Conduct Authority, the FCA, and as a financial services sort of regulated business, we also come under their watch, and they set, as you'll be, you know, sort of well aware, working in the advice sector, they set lots of the rules around how sort of financial services and debt-related firms kind of operate to make the market work, you know, effectively, and also importantly to help protect the customer, particularly, you know, looking to try and make sure that customer outcomes are positive.
Thank you, James. Let me get Craig Debbert from Equifax into the conversation. There is no doubt variation in scoring. Craig, how do you score or measure consumer data that is different from Experian?
Thanks for having me on. I think that's a really interesting question. And, you know, like James, I've worked in the credit reference agency for a long time, not quite as long as James, 20 years for me. I think James must have started very young. I know this is an audio-only podcast, but he's looking good for the amount of years he's been working in our industry. I think it's important to understand As James described, where the credit reference agencies came from, you know, the Equifax origin story is slightly different. Two brothers over in Atlanta, Guy and Kate Wolford, started Equifax back in the 1800s, and they were greengrocers who actually started sharing a book on how their customers performed against credit, and then started sharing that more widely with the banks and lenders to understand credit standing. Now, I know many of your listeners are based in the US. So in the US, they'll be very used to having one universal credit score, which is actually the FICO score in the US. And people tend to know that score. In the UK, it's different. It's important for people to understand the difference in the UK. So there is no universal score used by lenders and credit reference agencies in the UK. So it's not possible to directly compare the different credit reference agency scores. While at the same time, we often use very similar data, and James explains some of the ways that the companies share data, both lenders and then wider outside of those with broadband providers and utilities and that kind of thing. But each of those lenders will have their own credit policies, their own approach, their own appetite for risk, which means that there is a distinct variation in those scores. So when I look at the Equifax credit report and score service, we've designed that to help consumers understand the information on the credit report and how that can influence their ability to get credit. We use a traffic light system on the report so consumers can understand the positive and negative impact to their credit score. Alongside, we also provide links to FAQs. I know we'll do some top tips later, but FAQs and a knowledge center to provide our consumers as well with as much information as they need to understand how they can improve their credit score.
There is no doubt competition and collaboration between credit reference agencies about data and quality of data. Why would you say it's beneficial for creditors and debtors alike?
I think competition is vitally important in our industry because it delivers innovation. It delivers innovation for lenders. So companies like Equifax, we'll compete well in the market to try and innovate and solve the very latest challenges, whether that's relating to affordability, credit worthiness, identity checking, fraud prevention. And ultimately, as credit reference agencies, we're aimed at looking for good customer outcomes and helping our customers lend responsibly to those people that can afford to pay a loan back. Collaboration between the credit reference agencies has always been a priority for all of us. There's regular collaboration, and really that ensures consistency in credit reporting. It promotes data sharing, which is, we would all say, is vitally important to enable the market to get a good understanding of a risk in a consumer and that ability to lend responsibly. And that focus on the consumer. With it, at Equifax, our business purpose is to help people live their financial best. And we truly focus on the consumer and assisting that responsible lending practices.
If there are disputes, no doubt, unfortunately, you do get to a stage where there may be disputes on data information. How do you suggest the debtor to address such a conflict?
Well, I mean, the first thing I would say to your listeners out there is I would advise you to regularly check your credit report. It's a good cadence to get into to understand if there's anything unusual that may appear on there, because that could either be an error by a lender, or it could even indicate maybe some fraudulent activity or that kind of thing. So it's a good level of cadence to get into. If there is an error on your credit report, it's important that you raise that with the credit reference agency. Probably important to understand as well that the credit reference agency doesn't own the data. So we'll manage the dispute with the data supplier, be that a lender, let's say a bank, on your behalf. Once that dispute's been raised with the company, they have 21 days then to respond. While that's happening, we'll add a note on your Equifax credit report. So organisations are aware that the information is under dispute if they view your report. And then if the suppliers agree to amend the information, they'll usually do it either via an online portal, which they have access into us, or in the next cycle of data updates. If the lender decides that the information is correct, we will then close the dispute, because we can't change the data ourselves without the permission of the lender.
When there is data such as category judgment or IVA information, and I'm sure Registry Trust has a lot to say on this, but how do you collect the information? Is it all automated?
Yes, so it is all automated, and it's shared securely by relevant agencies, and this will be the same for all the credit reference agencies. CCJ data comes, as I'm sure you'll go on to discuss in a moment, from the Registry Trust. IVA data is maintained by the Insolvency Service. So when we talk about CCJ or a county court judgment, that's a court order that's sometimes issued by when a borrower is unable to pay their debts. It's one method that creditors can use to try and recoup the money from someone who's failed to pay back a loan. If a CCJ is issued against you, it will be recorded, with some exceptions, on the Register of Judgments, Orders and Fines, which was previously known as the Register of County Court Judgments. A CCJ can stay on your credit file for 6 years if not paid in full within 30 days. And lenders may look at past performance when assessing future credit or loan applications. So a CCJ on your credit report can serve as an indicator of poor previous financial behaviour. If a borrower repays the money within 6 years, then the CCJ will be marked as satisfied but still remain on the account.
Moving on to using data to create product and services, can you give an example where that has happened, or are we just dealing with creditors finding ways to recover the money?
So my role at Equifax, I look after innovation, so that's all of product innovation and development. So you're asking the right person, Reverend. So a debt management really starts at the point of origination, and the support that Equifax has provided our clients in making sound and responsible lending decisions to lend to those people that can afford to repay the loan. And this can be evidenced through a number of our products. We've released a new credit scores in the last year, called Risk Navigator 5, and they're focused on unsecured lending to help identify potentially high risk applicants and to minimize any individuals taking on credit they can't afford and unable to pay that back. We have new indebtedness scores, which give lenders an insight into level of indebtedness at an application to understand that debt to income ratio, again all centered around responsible lending. And we've recently released a product towards the back end of last year called Affordability 360. That's the first in the market, because it actually uses open banking, which I know has been discussed on this podcast in the past, and combines open banking along with traditional credit reference agency data and statistical data to provide what we believe to be the most accurate view of affordability. And why is that important to your listeners? Because actually, to get an accurate view of affordability may mean that somebody can actually get the credit they deserve, because the lender's taken a more forensic view of affordability and been able to grant the credit they need.
You have information on creditors and debtors. Where do you think innovation is heading toward as we speak in the consumer and debt data?
The UK has been at the forefront of open banking. And this groundwork has enabled secure consumer consent driven data sharing across the industry. And the industry is now looking to expand open banking into open finance, which will add new data sets like savings, investments, insurance and pensions. I think if you look more widely, it'll be interesting to see what happens with utility data and also telecommunications data. And I think we're heading to a place where as an individual, it's your data, and you can choose how that data is used. And I think consent-driven data will really drive innovation in the market. I think then when you look at artificial intelligence, that's a really exciting area. And we speak a lot at Equifax about explainable AI and using artificial intelligence in a responsible way. We harness all of this new capability along with the traditional data sets that we've held for a long, long time to really start to innovate in the market. And then I look at various different new sectors. Probably the most recent is buy now, pay later. But you tend to see innovation coming from the lenders and from those lending markets as well, which equally drives more innovation. So consented data, open finance, along with those new innovative ways of lending, I think all coupled with those new tools such as cloud native solution and artificial intelligence, I think all drives innovation in the market.
Who are your major buyers of data and for what purpose?
I think it's less about data sales and actually more around market insights and insights into helping promote responsible lending decisions and helping consumers live their financial best. So we obviously have the data layer as a foundation of our business, but then on top of that, we look to drive tangible actions for our customers to be able to, as I say, focus on consumers and help them achieve all they want to achieve in life by getting the credit they deserve.
Thank you, Craig. Let me get Chris Dick, CEO of Registry Trust, on board. Apart from credit reference agencies holding data of creditors and consumers, Registry Trust also plays an important part in the world of debt. How would you tell me what is it that your organization does in the context of Ministry of Justice?
Yeah, thanks, Ripon. Great to be with you this morning. So, I think a nice segue from the work that Craig's done there and a bit of an explanation around judgments. So at Registry Trust, we maintain the statutory register of judgments, orders and fines on behalf of the Ministry of Justice in terms of England and Wales, but also for the various jurisdictions around the UK and Ireland. So for Scotland, Northern Ireland, Ireland, and the Channel Islands and the Isle of Man, we'll also manage that data. And what that means in simple terms is that we do three things, really. One, we have responsibility for registering the judgments that we receive from those various jurisdictions, ensuring they are fit for purpose and making them available on the public register. That public register is available for individual searches, which we'll talk a little bit more about, and also made available for bulk data users, as Craig has touched on. And again, we can talk a little bit more around that. We're also responsible for promoting the value of the register and using the data from the register with other data sets to try and get a better understanding of indebtedness across the UK. And the third point I'd make is that we're also very keen to improve the quality of the data on the register so that it can support better data-driven decisions. So whether that's around the addition of claimant name, which you may be aware was a decision that the MOJ took as a result of our campaign and the government's consultation, the MOJ will be adding claimant name to the register, which we see as a very positive move for a number of reasons. We're also keen to look at moving the burden of satisfaction from the defendant in the case to the claimant. So where a defendant does pay off their debt, how can we ensure that the claimant takes responsibility for marking that debt as satisfied? As James and Craig have touched on, a satisfied judgment does allow for better credit reporting and improved credit scores. And also the potential for a register for partial settlements where individuals who've made some part payment back in settlement of a debt can get recognition of that on the register, which they're currently unable to do. We're a not-for-profit organisation. The register itself has been around since the mid-1800s, and we've been around for 40 years ourselves, a not-for-profit organisation responsible through that time for ensuring that the data is accurate when applying it to the register.
Just to kind of go deeper into the data that you hold, can you provide the difference between criminal court debts and civil debts that you hold?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, because I think there's a common misconception that we hold data on a broader range of judgments than we do. So we are purely the register for monetary judgments across those jurisdictions. So we don't hold criminal convictions. But where the various different types of judgments relate to a money claim, then that's what sits on the register. And as at the end of 2024, there's around 5.5 million of the various judgments that we hold on the public register.
Since the information in court, without taking this for granted, what do we mean by judgments?
Yeah, so certainly the UK-based listeners to this podcast will be perhaps most familiar with county court judgments or CCJs. I think those are the judgment types that are most commonly in the press and people associate with impacts on their credit reporting. But we hold a whole range of monetary judgments. The various jurisdictions will have different types of judgments. In Scotland, it might be decrees or ordinary causes, so different titles, but they will all relate in some way to a money claim that has been made and a court decision to uphold that claim and register a judgment. The vast majority of judgments that we hold on the register are judgments in default, where a defence hasn't been made against that judgment. And I think also worth noting that, as Craig has said, those judgments will remain on the register for a period of 6 years unless they are paid off within the first 30 days and therefore cancelled as a judgment.
Is it fair to say that the information you have is in the public domain, or do we have to pay for it to obtain it?
So I think both of those points are true. We're contracted to the Ministry of Justice. So we, as part of that contract, we make the data publicly available. So the online register, the face of the online register is our website, Trust Online, where individuals can go and pay to search on the register. So it is a paid search. There are different product types depending on what the individual's looking for and the range of jurisdictions they might want to search on. But that's where any individual and business can go online and conduct a credit search. Also, unlike often if somebody completes a data search, there isn't a footprint with that. So it's also a really easy way for somebody to check on the register if they or somebody that they're trading with has got a judgment. So that's an individual search. And then we also have a number of bulk data customers. So we will package that entire register and provide it by license on behalf of the MOJ to downstream data users.
In terms of updating the information, again, I know we talked about with Craig earlier about updating and correction. If the information is incorrect, how do we sort this out?
Yeah, so we work very closely with our bulk data users. So if we see a discrepancy in the data between, as an example, Experian or Equifax that we've got on the call today, we'll work with our team to make sure that any of those issues are ironed out. So they will query into us, we'll check the original court record, and we'll help them to make adjustments. If there is a challenge by an individual or a business on the accuracy of the judgment, then we do need to refer them back to the court. When we process the data, it's a matter of court record, and therefore we need to register and apply that data to match what the court and the judge has decreed in terms of the outcome. So if there is a challenge to the accuracy of that data itself, we will refer the individual or the business back into the courts to make that correction.
I mean, going back to purchase and selling, I know you said you can get information that you hold based on license or subscription, but who are the main purchasers of your information?
Yeah, so historically, our key customers would be the main credit reference agencies, and certainly they still are sort of predominantly responsible for the purchase of the data. But actually, we do see a number of other types of organisations now wanting to take our data, particularly in a world where it's incumbent on organisations to have a better understanding of financial vulnerability when undertaking business, not just in terms of lending money, but in terms of responsibility for good customer outcomes. And so we are increasingly seeing different types of businesses interested in understanding more about judgment data. But yeah, historically it would go into the big credit reference agencies, who would then use it with their downstream customers to inform those better credit decisions.
And finally, Chris, have you noticed any products or services developed as a direct result of purchased data from you?
Yeah, I think what's been really interesting in terms of our observations on the usage of our data is that you know, we're living in a world where more data sets are now becoming available, and you know, this is a register that's been around since 1852, as you said. So it's data that's been standing for a long time. And then you wonder, you know, how does that stay relevant in terms of getting a full picture and providing good outcomes? What we're increasingly seeing actually is that sort of binary nature of judgment data is really useful for people to apply alongside other new data sets. I know we might use open banking perhaps as a slightly lazy title, but the ability for organizations to get more data on individuals and combine it with what is quite a pure data set in terms of the data we manage is really quite interesting to see. So perhaps a move away from an overall blended credit score to people using different data to really provide a richer view on the customer and therefore support better outcomes.
Thank you, Chris. Dick, let me get Chris Leslie from Credit Services Association, which is the membership organization for debt collectors, into the conversation. Chris, your members must use credit reference agency data to collect debt. Instead of putting words into your mouth, how does a debt collector get consent to checking customers' data on credit reports?
Yeah, thanks, Ripon. And you're doing a great job lifting the bonnet and looking underneath how the wiring of this whole industry and this sort of sector works, because it can be quite complex stuff. And let me just sort of say at the outset, the Credit Services Association, we're the trade body representing well over 150 different organisations who are involved in either purchasing debt from creditors or the debt collection agencies, who are essentially organisations who will help creditors with the recovery process for any debts that are sort of overdue. But you know, specifically, you're looking at this the question of credit data and consent and credit reporting. So a lot of the debt collection agencies and debt purchasers won't necessarily sort of use the data in the way people expect, and this question of consent doesn't always occur. So there's three principal ways in which CRA data is used in collections and purchase contracts. First of all, debt purchasers can take on the responsibility for reporting how an account is managed when they purchase the debt. And so they report information to the credit reference agency. So actually, it can be about reporting it back, conversations that they had and information, debts repaid and so forth. So that can be a sort of two-way process. Second of all, there's a lot of data that's used to support tracing. So in fact, a lot of people who are owed money, creditors, it's not just banks, by the way, you can have small businesses who are owed money, window cleaners, gyms who are looking, you know, to recover some sums of money or whatever it happens to be, a vast range of organizations who come under the sort of banner of creditor. And they often need to check, you know, they're owed the money, they need to make sure that they're tracing the people who owe that. And this is done both by debt purchasers and debt collections agencies, just to update, verify and sort of confirm contact information. Sometimes they'll use a third party for that tracing process, but that's another way in which CRA, credit reference agency data, can be used. And then, of course, there is the third one, which is collections agencies or purchasers accessing this data to better understand a consumer's financial commitments and the context and the situation that they're in. And although what is visible to a collections agency or to a purchaser might be limited in certain ways, it can certainly help in the conversation with a customer understand their circumstances and the situation that, you know, their ability to afford repayment plan, for example, those sort of things. Now, all of the consent issues that you might ask are dealt with in the creditor, the originating creditor's privacy notices, but also all the different credit reference agencies have their own information notice, the CRANE process, as it's called. And those notices communicate to consumers how their data is going to be used, how it's going to be shared with the credit reference agencies. And that's, you know, done in a very technical and legitimate basis. Yeah.
When a debt has been sold to a debt purchaser or debt collection organization as part of industry practice, what kind of information do you then get? And will you also be getting the consumer credit agreement or not?
Well, I mean, there are different ways in which a creditor goes through the recovery process. Sometimes it looks to sort out arrears itself in-house. Sometimes it brings in external help, sort of outsourcing that process for specialist skills. That tends to go to the debt collections agencies. And sometimes it sells the book to a debt purchaser. And yes, prior to purchase, if a debt purchaser is thinking, right, I'm going to take on a book from a creditor, they will want to sort of know from the debt seller, from the creditor, what sort of stuff they're getting into. Debt purchasers don't get any credit reference agency data prior to the purchase process. As part of the sale, the creditor will give them a range of information to enable contact, to enable sort of recovery, and the provision of documentation like consumer credit agreements, the CCAs, can vary depending on the creditor, whether they've got it, whether they're willing to provide all of them at the point of purchase. It's usually, for instance, easier for online lending reasons, and whether the sale agreement will permit access or provision on a request basis. The agreement, the credit agreement, only really becomes necessary if there's some sort of dispute, or you know, about the nature of the debt, or during the if the consumer actually requests the consumer agreement, credit agreement, in themselves. And that doesn't happen in the vast majority of cases. So it's not always appropriate for the debt purchaser to be provided with every single one of these sort of quite big documents. Debt purchasers do like to assess an appropriate sample of account information, maybe sometimes including copy documentation, during the sort of due diligence stage. If you think about it, the purchaser wants to know, well, what kind of information does this creditor hold? And that's can often be where some information is shared with the potential debt purchaser.
Slightly go deeper into it, actually. So I know, and you may also have covered a bit of it, but access to credit reference agency data, what sort of information would a debt collector be interested in knowing? I know you covered it, about the consumer credit report, and why would it be?
Well, again, I mean, there's no point a debt purchaser taking on a book from a creditor who's already found often that the certain customers have got into arrears, unless they know themselves that they've got a hope of tracing, first of all, tracing those potential customers, and then helping recover some of the sums that are owed. So if it's tracing, it's often looking for contact information. Might be active credits if there are other addresses. It might be recent applications for credit with different contact information if that's already held. So the CRA data can be very useful in that process. If it's about carrying out the recovery and data is available, it can really, you know, help to understand a consumer's existing credit commitments. For example, does the customer have a mortgage? That can then give the debt purchaser or the collections agency a better idea about the customer's potential ability to repay. So although firms generally gather this information themselves through speaking to the customer, through engaging with the customer, having a conversation, what other commitments do you have? And they will have that data themselves. Credit reference agency data can help with some of that as well, give some insight into knowing and understanding the customer's circumstances.
And when there is, no doubt, a dispute, I know we briefly covered it, a dispute of facts or cases on credit report, and you receive a query related to the dispute with the initial credit, what do you then do and what options are available?
Well, I mean, it depends if it's a dispute about the debt itself or if it's a dispute about a credit report entry. Now, if it's a sort of complaint about the debt itself, we'd expect the debt collections agency to investigate it, but also, to the best of their ability, refer it back to the creditor if they don't have that necessary sort of information. So we'd expect the debt purchaser to do the same, although they should have a bit more information available to resolve it in-house, but they'll usually be able to refer it back to the creditor for information. If a debt collection agency has a dispute about an entry on a consumer's credit file, now that would be for the original creditor, for the creditor they're working with, who's reporting the information to the reference agency, to sort that out themselves and for the credit reference agency to do that. If a debt purchaser receives a dispute about a credit file entry and it was their own entry, well, then they would have to investigate that. If it's wrong, update it and also update it to the credit reference agency, if you see what I mean. So if there's another creditor's entry, including the original sort of creditor, then it would need to be dealt with by that original creditor. So it's essentially who the customers have that information with in the first place.
And we all know debts get passed around, unfortunately. And when does that happen? What do we see? And in terms of that work, what is shown on credit file?
Well, if a creditor is working in partnership with an outsourced DCA, a debt collections agency, then nothing would be different on the credit file. The entry's still managed by the creditor, so that's all dealt with directly, and there's no changes in terms of files there. If the book is then sold to a debt purchaser, well, that will show an entry in their name. And how that's displayed can often, I'm told, depend on the different policies of the different credit reference agencies themselves. So a couple of the credit reference agencies, I think, remove the original creditor's entry entirely and just have a new entry in the debt purchaser's name. But others have an entry for the original creditor, which has a sort of sold flag, and then a second live entry for the debt purchaser. So that's the way the process sort of works.
How does a debt collector treat a customer when there's a difference between a consumer credit debt and, let's say, criminal court fines?
Well, there shouldn't really be any difference in treatment depending on whatever's sort of flagged up in those ways. And that's, by the way, also something that's set out in the code of practice that the Credit Services Association holds. So as a trade body for the entire industry, we have a code of practice. All members of our association have to abide by that, and that's basically about professional standards of service. And if a customer feels that a debt collections agency or a debt purchaser hasn't abided by that, they can complain to us, and we will help try and resolve that. As was sort of said earlier, often it's not about sort of criminal fines. It's the monetary fines, really, that monetary sums that are owed that are principally the focus of a lot of this whole process. And the key thing, I think, is in terms of customer treatment. If a customer isn't engaging, if there's no dialogue, if there's no correspondence, there's nothing like that. Well, that's where a collections agency or purchaser will think about saying, well, we've got no option but to move to a more legal enforcement process. But if there's engagement, honestly, picking up the phone, having that conversation, customers can absolutely be assured that they will have a sort of dialogue with either the creditor or their collections agency, and often find that they will be able to negotiate a repayment plan that suits all sides. I mean, ultimately, it's in nobody's interests, the collections agency or the customer, just to have no dialogue whatsoever. Everybody should have an interest in resolving the problem, debt situation.
I mean, do you add interest once it goes to debt collectors?
No, I mean, debt purchase in general, they stop applying interest or charges to purchased accounts once they own it, and that remains the case. There's not a practice in the UK in that sense. So it's actually basically about recovering what is owed in that amount.
I'm sure you can imagine, Chris, debt collectors' industry have been transformed, let's say, in the last 10 years. Where does modern technology play, or let's say IA play these days?
Yeah, AI. Everybody's talking about AI, how it's going to change things. I mean, a lot of it, the communications, as you know, a lot of people actually like different type of communications. Some people will only really want to talk to a human being, and that's absolutely fine. I'm personally in that kind of category. Other people prefer not to sort of have that conversation with another person. They'll prefer to deal with it on their phones, mobile devices, or through WhatsApp, or all sorts of different ways. And technology allows that to happen. I mean, I think we're at a sort of moment in time, probably, where AI in the industry is sort of useful more internally for things like if it's a phone call conversation, the sort of writing up process of notes after the conversation has taken place, or just to support some of the quality assurance activities that firms undergo. So analyzing calls, making sure that happens and the calls happen in the right way, and for good regulatory and compliance reasons too. So that's sort of where we are currently with the sort of AI side of things.
I mean, on a wider scheme of things, where do you see the innovation is moving forward since the current government is very much interested in innovation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I was sort of saying, I think there are quite a lot of customers who just want to self-manage their situation, and a lot of the sort of chatbots and other things can help do that. And people can sort of have that interaction, and maybe increasingly without having to go on sort of stock answers and a lot of the bureaucratic side of things. I mean, I think there's probably some scope for AI to also be used in the advice sector too, and sort of help create tools for frontline agents as well. So with some of the queries that they get and come along. So it's actually a very positive thing in terms of communications. But we always have to be careful with some of the generative AI, too much reliance on it. We've all heard stories about sometimes AI can sort of have hallucinations about different customer, different sort of stories or other circumstances. So you've got to make sure it's based in fact. And also, feeding information into open AI platforms, there's all sorts of data protection questions that arise with that as well. And so our industry, like all other industries, are sort of have to work on that for data security reasons too.
Thank you, Chris. For those who are listening to Deck Talk podcast and want to share your experience on Deck Talk, you can get in touch with me on formerly Twitter, now X, at your Dr. Det, or email me ripon.ray@yourdrdet.com. Well, let me go back to my panel members to speak about top tips that they can give to Debt Talk listeners who are either seeking to improve their credit ratings, or if they have defaulted, or they want to find ways to resolve their debt. So let me start with James Jones from Experian.
So in terms of top tips, so we do a lot of work around public education. My team at Experian leads our public education outreach. One of the key things is really get to know your data. You by law, you can check your data with us for free. We call that your statutory credit report, and you can order that from all three credit reference agency websites. We also provide an online membership account, a basic free one that millions of people have downloaded the app, for example, to use, and that gives you your Experian credit score to help you make sense of the data. And obviously, if you do that and your score is maybe not at the top of the scale or near the top of the scale, we can then give you guidance on the things you might be able to do to make your credit history and therefore your credit score look more attractive to a typical lender. So the advice really is get closer to your data. We can help you do that. But then in terms of what next, it really depends on what your credit history looks like and what your, particular situation is, what your challenges, what your goals are. So, for example, if you've moved home recently, you might not yet have registered on the electoral roll at your new address. So that'd probably be one of the first things we recommend, because we include that information in credit reports. It helps lenders quickly and easily check your name, address, your periods of residence. And actually, it does positively affect our credit scores as well, typically by about 50 points. If you've been through a period of problem debt in the past, then we'd be sort of looking at other types of guidance typically. So making sure those debts were paid off and that the information on your credit report was successfully updated to reflect that. Sometimes things don't get matched and don't get updated. So we can raise disputes for people on their behalf, contact the creditors and make sure those debts are successfully concluded and updated. And obviously that will then look more positive in any credit score. I think at the same time, you probably want to be looking at ways to start collecting some more positive data. Lenders do tend to be more interested in your most recent information. So if you've had problems in the past, but you've shown that you've recovered and you're now successfully managing credit, then that will really help any future application you make. So things like credit builder, credit cards or getting your name on some household bills, that type of thing.
Thank you, James. And Craig Tebbutt from Equifax.
Yeah, so my three top tips for improving your credit score. Register to vote, set up direct debits, and review your report regularly. And if I just touch on register to vote, my daughter just turned 18, and I actually encouraged her to register to vote straight away. Not necessarily to vote, but because lenders want to understand that you live where you say you live, that they want certainty. And so it's one of the easiest ways to boost your credit score is to ensure that you're on the electoral roll at the current address. Set up direct debits, because missing a payment, as we've discussed today, can lead to problems on your credit file. So avoid that accidental missed payment, automate them through direct debit. And I think, as Chris said, communication is really important. So if you have missed a payment, speak to your credit reference agency, speak with lenders, and maintain that communication, because everyone wants to be able to solve a problem if one arises. And review your report regularly. Inaccuracy, unusual activity, it's really important that you understand your credit report and take action by speaking with your credit reference agency immediately. There's lots of other tips I could give you, Ripon, but we probably haven't got the time. But if your listeners are interested, they can visit equifax.co.uk, where we've got a knowledge centre which advises on debt management, money management and identity protection, along with more top tips around how to improve your credit report.
Lovely, Craig. How about Chris Dick from Registry Trust?
Yeah, I think some similar themes there. But from my perspective, as Chris Leslie mentioned before, really encourage people to engage with the process. I think it's clear that for those in financial difficulty, it can be really a difficult subject to talk about. It can be embarrassing to talk about financial difficulties. But you know, a lot of the issues we see are due to people disengaging with the process. So no matter how difficult those financial problems are, engage with the process, let's step into that issue and try and resolve it through mediation with the claimant. But the other two pieces from our perspective specifically, one, you know, if you can pay that judgment off, if you do find yourself with a judgment within 30 days, it's cancelled and that's removed from the register and therefore removed from your credit report. So timely action if you do find yourself with a judgment. And if you've missed that window, the value of still paying off that debt and then taking action to get that judgment satisfied. As I mentioned earlier on, at the moment, there's still no requirement on the claimant to mark that with the courts as satisfied. So do take action where you've paid a debt off to get it marked as satisfied through the courts. It makes a positive difference to your credit report.
And finally, Chris Leslie from Credit Service Association.
Yeah, we're all giving a similar top tip, but that engagement, you know, point, pick up the phone, have the conversation, have that dialogue. It's in everybody's best interest to do it. A lot of people are unnecessarily frightened, or they've got, you know, misconceptions about what will happen if they have a communication. You're invariably better off having that call, making that call, and resolving the debt in a sustainable way. You know, there's nothing to be gained by anybody putting a customer or a consumer onto an unsustainable repayment plan that then breaks. That's not good for the creditor, it's not good for the customer. So even if it's sometimes small regular repayments that are affordable, and that will be assessed by, you know, an affordability assessment that you can walk through in conversation, that's all very good stuff. And if you can't, you know, pay and really genuinely do have difficulties, then having those conversations will point you in the direction of really good professional debt advice, free and independent. And that can also even help maximize your income. A lot of people out there don't even get some of the welfare benefits and other things that they're actually legitimately entitled to. So again, that comes through conversation. The other thing I would say is, sometimes if you're searching online and you're in debt and you're in difficulty, be very wary. There's some scams out there. You know, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. Get better, proper, professional, independent advice. Don't fall for some of these scams that are out there, the sort of get out of debt free stuff that I'm afraid is a little bit too prevalent on the internet these days.
Thank you, everyone. I really do want to thank my panel members for giving their valuable and precious time out of their busy schedules. on the subject credit ratings and debt, my next podcast is on council tax debt and imprisonment. So thank you for listening to Debt Talk Podcast with me, your host, Ripon Ray. So thank you, everyone.